profit, barish, dengi, money, word of money comes from Mongolian language. Carol, guards, and all these stories. So what left, what was the legacy of Mongol Empire to Russia? Again, that was notion of Russia. Second, very strong feeling of insecurity and interest. I would rather say not interest, obsession in buffer zones. When you read Peter Hopkirk in his book, The Great Game, about rivalries of Russian and British Empire in Central Asia, Hopkirk explains it. The Russians were obsessed by the buffer zones because of the unmatched speed of Mongol cavalry, because when your border post is not able to inform you that the armies are crossing the border, because cavalry army would reach before your border postmen to the city. So they needed a buffer zone. After 100 years, the buffer zone was inhabited by Russians, and it becomes Russian territory, and they need another buffer zone. And in another 100 years, again, they need another buffer zone. So that's Peter Hopker's explanation of Russian expansion toward the east. What is interesting, Russians also saying it quite often, Mongol rule had left a legacy of strong authoritarian and centered rule. Because before Mongol conquest, most of the Russian principalities did have some sort of parliament, very nascent stage, which disappeared after Mongol period, and there was a Tsar with absolute powers, and the seat of Russian Orthodox Church was in Moscow, and Tsar was always coupled with the religious authority. And single-centered model of development, because from that period onwards, all the money is making turn around Moscow. And when you talk about such a large country, which is now one-sixth of the world land mass, and one city has all the money, so you can see the unequal development of the regions and centers in Russia. So, coming back to Mongolia. That's Moscow, Russia, and its expansion. So Moscow is here, and gradually it expanded toward the east. And that gentleman, Yermak Timofeyevich, is actually leader of the Cossack Band, who was hired by industrialist Stroganov to defend his own land against invading Tatar bands. And his band defeated Siberian Khanate and occupied most of Siberia. Not a regular Russian army. That's like British using corsairs. So it's more or less same model. So starting from Ivan the Terrible, Russia's Tsar started reconquering what has been left after Golden Horde. First they conquered Kazan Khanate, then Astrakhan Khanate, and then Siberian Khanate. Very interestingly, when Yermak defeated Siberian Khanate, he sent a letter to Ivan the Terrible informing that he defeated Siberian Khanate. And Ivan the Terrible did not believe it. He just simply left this letter with no attention. And that year, all the fur, which has been sent by this gentleman, was sold in Amsterdam for fair, and 8 barrels of gold has been secured. And then suddenly Russians remembered there was a strange guy who sent a letter with a farce, who claimed that he has conquered Siberian Khanate, and military detachment was sent, only to find this gentleman was killed, and his Cossack band has been disbanded. But Siberian Khanate offered no resistance, because by mistake or by chance, gentleman was killed, and his band disbanded, and Russian military garrison arrived 3 months later. So Siberian Khanate, by mistake, thought that it's a replacement of those Russians. So they offered no resistance. That's how Siberia was conquered. So now in 17th century, Mongolia was totally disintegrated. After maybe short rise of Tamerlan, the empire was divided into many, many parts, and which subsequently led to the disintegration of already disintegrated units. For example, Golden Horde has been disintegrated into Kirk Horde and White Horde, and then Nogai Horde, then Kramil Horde, and all this stuff. So China has been liberated from Mongolian rule in 1368. Russia has been liberated by 1480. Well, there is a difference between the two nations. China immediately entered into the hostilities with Mongolia proper because we were neighboring. And the Ming Dynasty had regular wars with the North, with Northern Mongolians. Whereas it took 300 years for Russians to come to Mongolian border because they had first to conquer Kazan Khanate, Astrakhan Khanate, Siberian Khanate, etc., etc. And when Russians came to Mongolian border, they found out there is no more China, because China was occupied by Manchus, by different nomadic tribe. Mongols were divided basically into three parts, what is called today Inner Mongolia, and what is called today Mongolia, that time Khalkha, and Dzhungar Khanate, or Oirats, Western Mongolians. And before Russians were able to create some formidable presence in their new Siberian territories, the conquest of China by Manchus were over. 1683, they conquered whole of China. Inner Mongolia was part of Manchu Empire by 1636. Central Mongolia, 1680. And Western Mongolians were defeated in 1755. Russians briefly bordered with Mongolians for some period, and then the border, Mongolian and Russian border immediately turned into Russian and Manchu border. That's why we see all the treaties between Manchus and Russians. Kalmyks, that's, if you can see in the corner, Kalmyk Khanate. Since they were on close to Russian territory, they became Russian subjects. And by the way, it's interesting, Dzhungar Khanate, Dzhungar in Mongolian is left hand. So why do you think the people in the west of Mongolia would call themselves left hand, left side? It's because Western Mongolian state, I didn't bring the map, was consisting from a large territory starting from Tibet, ending by Russia in the north, and Kalmyks were the western most part, and Dzhungars were the eastern most. That's why they called them Dzhungar, or left hand. That's the Dzhungar state. So, let me leave here for 200 years the history of relationship between Russian Empire and Manchu Dynasty. That's Manchu Qin Dynasty. That's a map by Englishman John Tallis in 1850, depicting the territories under Manchu. That's the Kangxi Emperor who conquered Mongolia in China proper, and who, by the way, his mother was Mongolian. Yeah, because you see, Manchu policy toward Mongolia was different. They were for assimilation of Inner Mongolians, because Inner Mongolians offered a contest to Manchus when they were fighting, when they were conquering China. So they didn't believe in the Mongolians. So from very early Manchu rule, it was possible for Chinese peasants to come to Inner Mongolia, settle down, etc., etc. Whereas Outer Mongolia, or today's Mongolia, was taboo for Chinese to enter, because Outer Mongolia First of all, they joined Manchu Empire by their own will. Secondly, they had kinship relationship with the Manchu Empire. So Mongolia was not taxed, no Chinese was not allowed to come and settle down in Mongolia. If anyone allows, his permission to stay would not exceed 3 years. Chinese cannot stay in Mongolian house. Chinese cannot marry a Mongolian woman. That was the relationship between Outer Mongolians and Manchus. Whereas in the Western Mongolians, who resisted Manchus for a longest period, there was just ethnic genocide. 1 million Mongolians were just simply cut out at that time. So by 1911, when there was a Shanghai Revolution in China, existing political situation dictated the policies of most of the nations of the region. Russians, in 1905, they were defeated by Japanese in a war. So Russia was looking at Mongolia as a natural border from their Siberian territories, especially a Trans-Siberian railway line. That's why Russia was supportive of Mongolian movement for independence, as they wanted to keep Mongolia under their zone of influence. Unfortunately, they could not annex Mongolia, because there was a general agreement among the superpowers that any superpower can take some region of China under their influence, but no one would offer a challenge to the sovereignty of the territory. So, so they were, even after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and loss of the Trans-Siberian Railway led to the loss of Siberia to the White Guards, the role of Mongolia as a buffer zone grew immensely. That's why the attitude toward Mongolia as a buffer zone remained the same during the Soviet period. And one of the close friends of Stalin, who was working in Mongolia, Ilyava, Georgian man, he, in his report, referred Mongolia as a nation, territory of which is more important than the population. So that's the nutshell of the Soviet attitude toward Mongolia. That's why Russian or later Soviet attitude toward Mongolia was always supportive of autonomy or independence of Mongolia as a buffer zone between Russia and China, and for some period, Russia and Japan. Newly created Chinese Republic regarded itself as legitimate heir of Manchu-Qin dynasty. So considered Mongolia to be a part of China. Mongolia could have been an arena of bloody conflicts at that time, but in the first years of Chinese Republic, the nation was quite weak to reclaim Mongolia back. Then it was engulfed into internal hostilities between the generals. And by the time when central power was restored in China, Mongolia was independent already for 25 years. So attitude of any Chinese government, nationalist, communist, whatsoever, was always expansionist toward Mongolia, claiming the country is detached by force. Mongolians had different attitude. Mongolians were of the opinion that both China and Mongolia constituted part of Manchu dynasty. And when Manchu dynasty is gone, both the nations restored their earlier statehoods. So Mongolia is separate state, and China is separate state. Again, that's why any Mongolian leadership, nationalist, revolutionist, etc., they were fighting for the recognition of independence of Mongolia. Moreover, they were fighting for the unification of all Mongol tribes. If you see this map, that's a map which has been issued in 1913. So today's Mongolia is like this. So that part, Tuva Republic, is now part of Russian Federation. And this part, Inner Mongolia, and that part, Barga, is now part of China. So In 1911, Mongolia declared independence during the Shanghai Revolution. Tsarist Russia supported Mongolia to limited extent its autonomy of China. In 1915, it was officially recognized in tripartite agreement between Mongolia, China, and Russia. And subsequent end of the World War I and Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and followed up by civil war in Russia, made Russian presence in Far East much weaker. And Chinese government immediately used this opportunity and conquered Mongolia in 1919. But shortly the Chinese occupation soon ended in the beginning of 1921, when Chinese occupation forces were defeated by White Guards of Baron Ungern. Very strange gentleman, Baltic German of Austrian origin, who claimed himself to be incarnation of Mongolian war deity Jamsrang, believed seriously in that, whose ambition was to recreate Manchu Empire back. And he entered into Mongolia in the end of 1920, and by the beginning of 1921 defeated Chinese forces in Mongolia and occupied the capital city. By the way, when he occupied the capital city, his forces were consisting about 4,000 Mongols, 600 Russians, and 140 Buryat Mongols, that's now in part of Russia, 200 Inner Mongolians, 80 Tibetans, 40 Japanese, 12 Czechs, and even one Englishman. So that was the international force which occupied the capital city of Mongolia. But his occupation was short-lived. By the way, he liberated capital city, announced back independence of Mongolia, created new Mongolian government, and took new position in the government. The government consisted only by Mongolians. I always ask myself, commanding all his forces, he was in control of Mongolia, why he did not become, at least prime minister of that time. And later studying, I understood he would not take position in Mongolian government because he was married a Manchu princess, and he was deeming himself to be a future Manchu emperor. So why should he take some position in part of his own empire? But his forces were soon defeated by Mongolian revolutionaries who reconquered capital city in July of 1921 after 5 months, and again declared independence and declared the country as a constitutional monarchy. This gentleman is Mr. Tanza, founder of Mongolian People's Party. As you can see, it's a hard devil's back. The gentleman standing next to him is an American businessman called Coleman. And it appeared that founder of my party was a dealer of Harley-Davidson in that part of the world. So I believe that those who started all this revolution in Mongolia did have very little understanding or no understanding of communism as such. They were fighting for independence, and they were looking at Russians as someone who would help the country to become independent. Whereas Soviet attitude toward Mongolia was dual at that time. It's because of the character of the Bolshevik Revolution, because in the Bolshevik Revolution there were two types of communists. One was internationalist and one was nationalist. Internationalists simply believed that there will be soon world communist revolution, and all of the nations in the world would become communist, and they would live in happily ever after in one big communist family. So those were looking at Mongolia as convenient base for revolution in Asia. And if you see later on, first Mongolia became pro-communist, and then China, and then Korea, followed by Vietnam, Indochina, etc., etc. So that was quite a realistic perspective. The nationalists were looking at Mongolia more as buffer zone from the invasion from China or Japan. of that period. As I said, the founders of the Mongolian People's Party probably did not have any notion of communism, but they soon had been replaced by new youth who has been trained in Soviet universities, and by the 30s, country was under strict control of Comintern. We repeated all the major processes that has taken place in Soviet Union, starting from leftist deviation, rightist deviation, repressions, and all these stories. But Mongolian territory was important for Soviets, not only as a buffer zone, but as a support of communist movement in China. Weapons have been supplied from Mongolian territory to Chinese communist armies, to Kuomintang, to Fenyusen, whomsoever Soviets regarded to be as a revolutionary force in China. Sometimes they made a mistake, sometimes they were doing good, etc. Very interesting that the mystical expedition of Soviet scientist Rurik in search of mythical land of Shambhala has started from Mongolia in 1928. So in this period, especially at the period in 1931 when China, in northern China, was occupied by Japan, Japanese Empire, Mongolia briefly bordered with the Empire of Japan in mid-90s. And that led into the Battle of Khalkhin-Gol in 1939, where Soviet army came in support of Mongolian army, who was having a border conflict with Japanese forces and crushed them in that battle. By 1945, Mongolia was strong enough to participate in a war against Japan in Far East. Perhaps not everybody in this room would suspect that we were allies during the World War II in the same coalition. And almost every second or third able-bodied man in Mongolia was dispatched to this war. And it's called Liberation War, if you see. I was always asking myself, why should you send so many young Mongolians to fight Japanese for liberation of China? And why would you call it Liberation War? And if many Mongolians would have been killed, would people pardon Mongolian leadership at that time, killing for so many young Mongolians for liberation of China? And especially in the situation when 2 million strong Soviet army entered into China anyway, the 80,000 Mongolians would not make difference in these battles. And when I read the text of appeal of commander-in-chief of Mongolian Armed Forces, Marshal Chebalsan, I suddenly understood. He was talking about liberation of Inner Mongolia. So why this war is called Liberation War? Because it was liberating Inner Mongolia. And if you see, this too is Mongolian army. All is Soviet. And if you see, Mongolian army stopped at Kargan in Jehe, Chinde. It's a Great China Wall, what is considered to be a border between Mongolia and China proper. Of course, he was dreaming of uniting back in Mongolia, but his dreams did not come true because soon China became communist country under Mao, and Stalin needed communist China, especially in the situation of atomic monopoly of the United States. Well, after World War II, it seemed that Mongolia was totally in friendly neighborhood. Soviet Russia, Soviet Union, and People's Republic of China in the North and in the South. But a brief period of honeymoon between two communist states was soon over. And in the 60s, Soviet-Chinese rivalry turned into really military standoff. And Mongolia had to take part of the Soviet Union during that standoff.